they'd need to make something like $20 a head. Facebook would have to be one of the most popular places to spend ad dollars in the world. That's the future that investors are betting on when they buy a share of the social network. Zoe Chace, NPR News.
Syrian opposition activists say government troops have been shelling a rebel-held town just north of the rebel stronghold of Homs, itself battered for months by government assaults. A spokesman for the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says rebels in the town of Rastan, which has been under their control, have destroyed several army vehicles today. The violence further undermines a UN-backed peace plan that was to start with a ceasefire. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, who values straightforward reporting and straightforward banking. Learn more about Ally Bank at allybank.com.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House, providing housing and food service to University of Illinois students for 64 years. Hendrick House works to ensure a quiet environment for study and relaxation. More information is available at 365-8000 or at hendrickhouse.com. WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are not going to be able to do the show that we had planned for the first hour. We were going to talk with Ben Locke from Penn State about college student mental health. We will talk about that on another day. Instead, for the first hour of the show, we'll go to the Focus archives, and we'll be bringing back a conversation that we first had in January with Alex Shakar. He teaches English here at University of Illinois, and we talked about his novel Luminary, which is his second. So that'll be the first hour. I do want to remind you that we will be back here live, hour number two, as usual. And in that hour, we will talk with Dario Maestropieri from University of Chicago. He has studied primate and human social behavior for a long time. We'll talk about what you will find in his new book, Games Primates Play, which looks at the various parallels between human behavior and the behavior of our closest animal relatives. So that'll be hour number two. So in this first hour, we hope you'll enjoy listening to this interview. And as you listen, do keep in mind that for this hour, we will not take calls. This morning, at this part of the show, we'll be talking with Alex Shakar. He's a novelist. He teaches creative writing here at the University of Illinois. And we'll be talking about his new novel, his second novel. The title of the book is Luminarium. It's published by Soho Press. It's just been out here for a while, and it's gotten a lot of positive notice. And it deals with some very interesting and very big subjects. Things like questions like this. Where does religious experience come from? Is it the result merely of some random activity that happens in our brains, or is it something more than that? And if we could reproduce that experience, the experience of the divine, by artificial means, would it be any less real? Just a few of the questions that he explores in the book. Now, basically, it revolves around a man named Fred Brunian, who, in the midst of crisis, both personal and professional, volunteers for a study searching for the roots of faith, and definitely it ends up changing his life. It's a good story, and I would recommend people take a look at it. And I'm very happy to have Alex Shakar here in the studio with me to talk a little bit about this book and about writing. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate it. I think it's a book that deserves to be called literary fiction, but at the same time, and it explores some very big and interesting ideas. But at the same time, the character is very compelling, and I think you tell a good story.
Thanks.
I think you don't often find all of that in one package. And I know many of the people who have written about the book and reviewed the book have said the very same thing. It's nice to have you. It's always good to have people here in the studio with me. And one reason is that we can have them read. And I'm thinking maybe almost before doing anything else, that I might ask you to read a little bit. And I thought that perhaps you might read a little bit from the very opening of the book, just because I think it grabbed me right away. And I think that it then gives us a good opportunity to go from there and talk about, all right, so what is this? Who is this man that we're introduced to right away? What's going on with him? And go on from there. So maybe that would be a good way to to start.
Okay, sure. I'll start just a couple pages in. So, as you said, Fred, our hero Fred, has entered this clinical trial, and he's walked into this very small cube-shaped room, and he's standing facing an old black vinyl recliner that's kind of ripped, and there's yellow foam coming out of one of the arms, and there's an arm that's looks like it's from a desk lamp that's attached to the back of the chair, and at the end of the arm there's a sparkly gold vintage motorcycle helmet with all these wires coming out of it, and so Fred is a little bit dubious about whether or not to sit down in the chair, but his life is not going too well right now, and his fiance has just left him, and his company has been stolen from him, and his twin brother, who is also his business partner, is dying in the hospital. So the thought of sitting down in the chair for a spell just isn't so bad at this point. And plus, he's already a little bit into this woman who's led him into the room. Her name is Mira Egghart. "We'll be watching over you the whole time," Mira Egghart explained. She crossed to the other side of the recliner, taking a plastic jar from a steel serving trolley. "I'm going to stick some electrodes to you. They're just to record brainwaves and vitals. I'll have to apply a little gel for conductivity." She confronted him with a glistening dollop on her fingertip and proceeded to rub cool spots of the stuff onto his temples and the center of his forehead. Silvery rings adorned at least three of her fingers, moving too fast and close for him to get a good look. After gelling each point, she reached down to the table for a poker chip-sized white pad and stuck it on. Her eyes avoided his as she worked, darting instead around the various features of his cranium. "Undo the top two buttons of your shirt, please." She counted down the ribs from his clavicle with a sticky fingertip, dabbed more gel, and painted a tiny wet spiral over his heart. Her hair smelled like freshly opened apples and something ineffable. Dry ice, he thought. One of those dizzying alchemies of hair product research. From the degree to which she was leaning over him, he counseled himself not to look down her blouse, and the slight squint in her eyes, he thought she must be nearsighted. The wrinkles at the corners suggested she was around his age, mid-30s. Her nose, though not indelicate, had a slight fin-like curve to it, which, taken in combination with those dark, peering eyes, gave her the slightly comical look of an inquisitive bird. He wondered how many condemned men, as they were being strapped into electric chairs, had spent their last moments checking out the ladies seated among the witnesses. She reached up and pressed the helmet onto his head. "The session will last 20 minutes. All you have to do is sit back and relax. Let's get you reclined. The lever's on the right." He did as told, window swinging away, ceiling swinging into view. Directly above, in the firmament of perforated tiles, a poster of a spiral galaxy had been taped. Mira Egghart's upside-down head, like a wayward planetoid, floated into view. "You probably won't want to, but if you feel you need to stop, just say the word. The helmet has a mic attached. Or if you can't speak, just wave. Please don't handle the helmet yourself." "If I can't speak?" I'll stop there.
I think that's wonderful. As I said, that was enough. I said, okay, you've got me. And I think that we also then end up learning that Fred has been in the hospital visiting his brother, who is very ill with cancer, and he's in a coma, his twin brother. And he's sitting in the cafeteria of the hospital, and Mira, this woman, she comes in, and she puts up a flyer. And that's what she gets his attention.
Yeah.
And he goes over and looks at it and sees that what she's looking for is people willing to be experimental subjects to do this, to go and to put on the motorcycle helmet with the wires. And he's intrigued with her. He's hard up for cash, so he figures, well, he could use the money that they're paying for the subject. And I think also maybe the whole purpose of the subject, I mean, the purpose of the study, you know, this idea that the people are trying to achieve some sort of union of intellect and spirit without, it's sort of like religion without the religion. They're sort of asking this question, well, is that possible? And what happens if they by artificially stimulating the brain of the person has what we would call a mystical experience or religious experience. And then now that's a lot, just right to lay on the table right there. But that's kind of what gets him to this point where he finally sits down in the chair and they put the helmet.
And it's also something that I think that that his brother would have done, you know, which is why one of the reasons he's interested in it is his brother George was more into these kinds of things. George meditated. George was a seeker in a way that Fred could never really get his mind around. So that's another motivation that Fred has when he sees this flyer and he's thinking about it. It's, you know, it's something that George would have been excited about. And he hears the kind of voice of his brother in his head, inner George, which is always mm-hmm. talking to him. So that's another reason he enters the study.
And he and his brother George, Fred and George, are twins with kind of closeness, both closeness and both differences that you see in twins.
Yeah. They, you know, one of the interesting things about twins is how they start out, you know, coming from the same place with the same genes and then, you know, whether it's randomness, whether it's just the little encounters, whether it's just they choose one sort of differentiate, they choose ways to differentiate, they start splitting off a little bit. So there's an intense closeness between them, but there's also some pretty big differences which Fred has, you know, trouble understanding, and he thinks does he know George, but then why has George done the things he's done? So there are some mysteries that happen in the book too.
Yeah.
Fred, the book also starts off with Fred starting to get mysterious messages from someone claiming to be George.
So, he's sitting there in the cafeteria and he's looking at his laptop and he gets an email that purports to be from his brother who happens to be upstairs in a coma.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, Fred's reaction as the completely rational man, the idea that this could be somehow, you know, his brother communicating from some other dimension, he doesn't quite want to accept that, and yet he also can't quite let it go, even though his sort of paranoid side says, well, someone's just yanking my chain here, and it couldn't possibly be. But then he seems a part of him is also asking this question, well, could it possibly be that, in fact, somehow this message is coming from his brother?
That's right.
And that's just all within the first few pages of the book, and it goes on from there. And I guess, you know, I'm sure that people are always interested in what little things, what little sparks come along for writers that start them down the road from what ends up being a finished book. And one of the things, I guess, that did indeed start you on this was that you read about a researcher who was actually doing something like this, or trying to do something like this.
That's right. There is a researcher in Canada who invented a helmet, which the claim is that it gives people the sense of a presence. If you stimulate one hemisphere, people will see a benevolent presence, whether it be an angel or, you know, a friend. And if you stimulate the other half, you're not so lucky. So, the research is controversial, that sparked for me. I thought that there's a kernel there of something that might make a fun story to work around. So, I started doing a lot of research into what the possibilities are, just theoretically, you know, like, in terms of what we know about how certain experiences are caused. So the helmet in my book, the book takes place in 2006 in New York City, but there's it's located in a definite place and time, and it's not science fiction, but my helmet does a lot more than a helmet could do in the present day and time. But all these things are theoretically possible. You know, things like the first week, Fred has the experience of his consciousness kind of expanding into the room, and him being one with everything being contained within his, the chair is a part of him and the room is a part of him. And then he has other kinds of very different and increasingly intense peak experiences as the weeks of the trial go on.
Yeah. And that, for the purposes of the book, when I was reading the book and I was in the story, I mean, I was willing to give myself over to the idea that such a thing could be possible. But afterwards, of course, you ask yourself, well, now, wait a minute. Is such a thing possible? Has anybody ever tried to do that? So at least someone has sort of dipped their toe in the water here. And the idea is that, well, maybe such a thing would be possible.
Well, I mean, it's coming pretty quickly. I personally think it's almost inevitable. Uh-huh. They've already given people out of body experiences in laboratories, not in the way that my helmet does it in the book, uh-huh. but through virtual reality but people definitely have the experience of being out of their bodies. And,
well, so here, I guess, among the many questions that it invites, we know that there are people who have said that they have had these kind of experiences and have used various techniques. People have spent their life in meditation, and they've used mind-altering substances, and then they've done all kinds of things to get to that place that the machine takes Fred in the book. And I think one of the questions that the book invites is this. Well, say you spend your lifetime in meditation and you can get to that point, or you can put on the sparkly helmet and get to that point. Are those two experiences equivalent? I mean, is it this, you know, is if it's if it's quote unquote artificially induced, is that a real religious experience? And is it that the same that your, you know, man who spent his lifetime on top of the mountain and finally attains enlightenment gets? Are those two things the same?
Well, I think this is one of the questions that Fred has. And it's never easy for him, because he has these experiences and they're intensely meaningful to him. And then right afterward, he goes into the little room with Mira, his experimenter, and it's very important to her and to the experiment that she explain exactly how these things happen. So he gets a very detailed neurological explanation of what was done to induce these feelings and these experiences, but they're still very, very real to him, and there are still some things that he can't quite explain in his life. So, I think that's a question. I mean, it was a question for me, and it was one of the reasons why I started to, be interested in the subject and write the book. And I think, you know, as much of it, it's a journey for Fred, and it was a journey for me as well, writing the book and researching these things. And the more that I researched this, the more that I started to realize that I didn't really know what spirituality was, even, you know, like I had started off, you know, kind of like Fred starts off in the book, thinking that it's spirituality is like, well, it's basically about believing something. I have a set of beliefs, you know, and the more that I read about it, and then eventually I started to meditate too, and I started doing Zen meditation, and the more that I came to the view that there's really another aspect to it, which is looking into and looking through the believer, and what that believer is, you know. So I think that there are all kinds of ways that we have these two camps, you know, in our culture, you know, which are, you know, there's a sort of a secular atheism on the one side, and there's this fundamentalist kind of religion on the other side, and there are opportunities, you know, that there are ways that these two camps are, it's almost a false dichotomy in some ways. For there are ways that neurologists on the one hand and spiritual practitioners on the other hand are coming to some similar conclusions about the things like the nature of the self and stuff like that.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Alex Shakar. He teaches creative writing here at the University of Illinois in the English department. It is the author of Luminarium. It's his second novel. It's published by Soho Press. It's out now. There is an event that's overshadows this whole thing, the whole story. And as you say, it's set in New York City, set in 2006. But the thing that really kind of looms over it is 9/11, in some ways that we won't go too far to discuss. But I understand, having read about you, is that you were actually in New York City on 9/11. With, I think you're visiting your family.
Yes, that's right. My first novel, The Savage Girl, was about to come out. It was coming out. I think the pub date was like September 18th, 2001, and there was a lot of lead. It was very exciting for me. You know, I gotten a big advance for the book, and there was a lot of excitement about the book, and there was a lot of advance publicity, and it was my first novel, and so. Then my editor died right before the book had come out. So I was in New York actually for his memorial service, which was on September 10th. And then on the morning of the 11th, I was about to leave for the airport when I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and my parents still live in an apartment in Brooklyn where I grew up. It was a very sunny day, I remember, and we heard, just a noise like thunder. And didn't think it was really anything until the cable channels were still working. And so we started to see it. And then I went up to the rooftop, and I could actually see the towers from the roof of the apartment building where I grew up. I stood there. My father was up there too, and we watched first the first tower on fire, and then the second one, and there were all these slips of pieces of paper that were just flying all the way from Manhattan over Brooklyn, and it was like a cloud of paper, and we didn't know what they were. We thought maybe they were notes from the terrorists or something, and then my father caught one, and it was just a legal document, you know. Yeah. So it was an awful day, and I remember just going out like everybody else, trying to figure out what to do, you know, like how, some way to help. You know, there was not much way to help. You know, I what were my skills? I knew a little French, like you know, what's on your resume? You know, like what can you do? You know, but and then after that, I was faced with the event really touched me very, very indirectly, but I saw that it had a definite impact on the release of my novel, which was a novel about sort of about consumerism, and it was a sort of a humorous novel about it was also a very incisive novel, but it was about trend spotters and consumerism and these things that were just not on the radar after 9/11. And in fact, you know, to consume became became a very patriotic thing to do after 9/11, and that was what we were told to do. So I was flying around the country trying to do a book tour for this book, and just getting onto a plane was everybody was kind of eyeing each other, trying to figure out, you know, well, are you one of those guys? It was a very tense time.
Well, I mean, it also strikes me that I'm sure in some ways that Luminarium then comes out of this moment when a lot of artists, creative people, writers, what have you, were all feeling these emotions and had these questions coming out of 9/11. And I think everybody was saying, all right, now, as at least those people who are artists who make things, they were all saying, all right, now what do we do now? I mean, what do I paint now? What do I write now? What song do I write now? What novel do I write? How do I respond to this moment where it seems like everything is now up for grabs. And it seems that Luminarium sort of comes out of that set of questions.
I think it does, and it's also kind of about that in a way. You know, I mean, for me, it was about that whole phenomenon of how do I take this event and make meaning out of it? How do I make personal meaning in my life about it? And so Fred himself is a little bit skeptical about all these people, you know, writing 9/11 novels and you know, making 9/11 movies. And it takes a while, you know, as the book unfolds to find out exactly what's behind that for Fred. Mm-hmm. But that was a little bit of my feeling too, you know, coming out of this. I was looking at the ways that you know, the ways that people were just being very loud, and over this whole decade too, we had the burgeoning of these cable TV channels in which, you know, people were shouting their opinions at each other, and it was a time of war, and it was a time of just very, very strenuous opinions on. And it was a time of deepening divides, you know, also between religious and secular, between all these things that were figuring into it. And so for me, that all became a part of the story. And that was when 2006 rolled around. I'd started out actually like trying to, you know, I'd started out early on setting the novel a little bit earlier, right after 9/11. And it was just too soon. And it was too soon for me to be writing about it, honestly. And it took a while for me just to sort of sit back and watch everybody else and watch how the decade was unfolding. And when 2006 rolled around and I was there at the memorial on 2006, and I thought this is the time, because it was a really interesting time. I thought, you know, it seemed like a time when the event was finally not quite present, and it was just starting to pass into history and even myth, and the 9/11 deniers were out in force. And incidentally, I was at the last one in 2011, and they've tripled or quadrupled in size. Interestingly, the people who think that 9/11 was a conspiracy of the U.S. government, and, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a time anyway in 2006 when it was passing into history and just starting. There were, you know, children, you know, and teenagers there who barely remember the event, or, you know, just people who are experiencing it various, very different ways, and all sorts of groups, lots of like news and camera crews and people just still trying to interpret this event. So, in a way, like, I had hoped that the book itself would function a little bit like that hole in the ground, you know, where people are trying to figure out, people are trying to ascribe some, you know, and derive some meaning to and from it, you know, and whirling around it, you know.
Yeah. Another sort of element of the story has to do with this company, the software company that Fred and his brother, and they have another brother. They're three brothers work in this company. That I think ultimately was the dream of George, and he had this idea that they could create a kind of a utopian virtual reality game that people could go into and create some kind of ideal world, and not only just spend time there and have that be entertaining, but have it be something that would be a vehicle for their spiritual improvement. And of course, the sour turn that it takes is that, and that's one of the things that right at the beginning that Fred is so unhappy with, is that it ends up being taken over by a military contractor who, and it gets turned into something to train troops. The kind of military shooter games that now people play or people can imagine that's intended to train people to be in battle, which is a complete turnaround in what it was that at least George, yeah, at the beginning, what he thinks that this could be.
Yeah, yeah. They you know, this starts off, you know, in the 90s. It's this utopian dream, basically, that George has. And it's also, and they get tons of venture capital. they get lots of funding, and they're part of the dot-com boom, and they're riding high, and so they've got lots of money and lots of hope, and then after 9/11 the funding dries up, and they chase the war dollars down to Orlando, Florida, where something called the Military Entertainment Complex, this is what programmers are calling it, mm-hmm. is forming down there, because they've got a lot of there's the military simulation industry is basically what it is, and they've got Pixar programmers down there, and they've got people from computer game companies who are down there, and they've also got lots of military contractors and bases. So that whole thing becomes this complex down there, and this is actually all based in fact. And in fact, one of my inspirations for their company was that a friend of mine had a company in the 90s, which was this virtual world for children, which had all this funding, and then after 9/11, they saw themselves, you know, transformed into a virtual training ground for the Army. So I had a very you know, and when I saw this story, I mean, this is what novelists look for, you know, is these kinds of. I think that writing is kind of this holographic kind of thing, with a hologram, it's like the part tells the story of a whole. You know, you look at a piece of a hologram, and you can sort of see vaguely the whole image. Mm-hmm. So this was a little story for me that told a larger story of the times and how the times were changing, and. So, Fred and George and their younger brother Sam are in this company, and then gradually they didn't sign the contracts quite right, and they didn't get enough lawyers, and they thought that they would be, you know, that they were in a pretty good position, but gradually they found themselves having less and less power within this huge conglomerate. And their companies eventually wrested away from them.
Yeah, and that's just, again, to go back to the little bit that you read at the beginning, that's just, you know, that's, you put Fred in this incredible position. He's been through that. They've lost the company. His brother's in a coma. His life's fallen apart. His significant other has left him. It's just about everything you could possibly heap on this poor guy, you have done to start him out.
Well, you know, I needed something that, for a long time, it was a struggle with figuring out, you know, what is really going to impel, you know, and compel Fred to go on this journey that he does, because mm-hmm. he goes through some pretty big transformations and goes through a lot of twists and turns, and so I needed the right kind of set of things to motivate that to happen. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, I didn't have George in the book even, and that was. You know, it was always in the back of my mind. Maybe you should have George. Maybe you should have my brother. And I just thought, no, that's
someone
too much.
Was speaking
that's too much.
To you with it. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
I thought, you know, and so I tried giving Fred heart condition, and I started having chest pains myself, and it just wasn't working. But I think that once I found George as an element in the book. You know, he's not the central character, and he spends the whole novel in a coma, but in a way he is the center of the book, and he's the heart of the book. And once I had him, I found all these things, these other elements of the book just kind of snapping together in a way that, you know, writers really hope to see.
Yeah. In this hour of focus, our guest is Alex Shekar. We're talking about his novel, Luminarium. It's his second. It's published by Soho. Press, his first, The Savage Girl. You might want to look at that as well. And he teaches fiction writing here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. You were talking just a little bit ago about, you know, part of this detail, this aspect of the life of the boys here, the Brunian boys' life, comes from the fact that you knew somebody who actually had that experience. Makes me think about, again, the old saw about writers writing what they know, and about how that doesn't necessarily mean you can't go out and do research, you know. So I'm sure that you had to, you borrowed some little things from your own experience, but also you had to do brain research to make that part of it sort of plausible. And as you explained, you took up Zen meditation in part to you know, sort of know what that experience was all about. So what has that done for you? How what has that, aside from that being in part maybe research for the book, has that done something for you in your life?
Yeah, I feel that it has, and I'm still doing it. So, and I'm done with the book. So, and it's still a big part of my life. So, I feel that it's really shifted my perspective and shifted my focus. And it's still, you know, that kind of just looking, just a way of being present in the world. And a way of It's you know, I mean, Fred himself starts, you know, meditating a little bit and has some experiences where I try to at least start writing about that, or about the experience of being, of bringing the world a little bit closer and being able to be a little bit more present in it, and also having the word detachment is used, but it doesn't mean like a sort of a dead cutting off. It means like an ability to see one's own thoughts coming and be able to react to it, have that little space of reaction time. So those are the practical things that I think that it does for people. And then there's just that question of who we are and what we're doing here that is still a compelling question to me. So.
Yeah, that preoccupation with reality is particularly a Buddhist one, I think. And you know, if there's anything that maybe would be appropriately called an intellectual religion, I think it would be Zen. I don't know how much really Zen practitioners would say, "Oh, I'm all wet." That's really not the case, but it seems that way to me.
Yeah, it's got that reputation, and there is that aspect to it. But at the same time, it's really about cutting through that completely. You know, just about. Not relying on conceptual, you know, thought. I mean, being able to function in it, to use it, but also to not be embedded in it.
Yeah. What would you like to read something else from the book?
Sure. This is I wanted to read something from the second part of the book, and it's a bit of a challenge because it's. You know, there are so many things that would just give something away, or that would take a lot of setting up. But here's something that's just it's a dream that Fred's having, and so there are all kinds of pitfalls and that he's fallen into in revelations that he's had, his life is kind of unraveling and snapping together all at once, and he's just been through. Another helmet session. This is a stranger kind of session in the way that it happens, but he's seen a divine presence, and now he's been having these disorienting dreams, and this is a dream in which the presence is kind of personified, and it's in the dream, and his waking life, he thinks in the dream was a dream, and now he's awake. Drifting off now, forgetting why his sleeping bag feels part of him, a chrysalis, the half-shed skin of a snake. All that was a dream from which he awakens in a small white cuboid room. Behind a control room window stands a being of light in a pristine white lab coat. It's the presence, its face pure brightness, like a sun that doesn't hurt the eyes, like that light at the tunnel's end. The presence escorts him through bright white corridors into an elevator with a panel of buttons arranged in a spiral. With a finger of light, it presses the outermost. Fred can feel the compartment arcing around as well as pressing upward in a vast spiral. Meanwhile, the presence conveys it to him. An important mission is underway, a mission in which Fred has a role. The doors open onto an observation deck. Below lies a circular, shadowy maze of a city. The roofs are all off to reveal the interiors, some of which he recognizes. He spots the dim loft room of his former office. He spots his parents' apartment with its colorful kitchen floor and ancient living room rug. He spots a miniature golf course glowing an unnatural shade of green. Surrounding these interiors are endless twisting corridors and drab institutional rooms. And at the center of the city lies a central darkness, a gaping hole, in which a funnel of gray clouds churn. and the city is ever so slowly spiraling into it, the innermost parts crumbling and plummeting over the rim. The presence tugs on Fred's white satin cape, and with that glowing finger, directs his attention upward. The black dome above is filled with icons, a golf club, a shot glass, a lightning bolt, and many more. The dome is not yet bright enough, the presence telepathizes, to accomplish the mission. Fred asks what the mission is. He's led to understand, to awaken a dreamer. Fred asks who the dreamer is. The presence gestures to a mounted scenic viewer by the railing, through which Fred then peers, down into the city maze, into the innermost curl of the spiral, at a point mere yards away from where it tumbles into the vortex, into a room edging inexorably, inch by inch, toward the brink, a hospital room, wherein, in bed on his back, head turned to one side, lies the little figure of George.
And that's, once you get to that point in the story, an awful lot has happened, and much of that refers to earlier events. So it's maybe for people that would be a little mysterious or not quite sure what to make of that, not having read through the story and know how it gets to that point. What are you trying to get across there, do you think?
Well, there are a lot of things. I picked that passage. I knew it would be a little bit mysterious, but it kind of gives a picture of Fred's life in a way. With that miniature city that he's seeing, and his life is encapsulated in that way. And so the vortex is, you know, Fred's family is a part of the novel too. Fred's mother is a practitioner of a kind of faith healing called Reiki, and she's been working on George, and she's been feeling that George energy is coming from George, and that George is trying to save the city in a way. And she's seeing a vortex of energy and this, you know, so that's figuring into it. And Fred has an adventure on, you know, there are a lot of comedic elements in the novel too. Yeah. And Fred has an adventure at a miniature golf course, and so this is kind of a misadventure, and so, you know, this is figuring into it. And so all these elements of Fred's life are kind of wrapping around this, and all the different images from the novel are starting to come together.
Yeah. Now, as you mentioned, Fred and George's mom is a practitioner of this Japanese healing technique, sort of a laying on of hands thing, although it doesn't, I guess, involve actually laying on of hands, but that's kind of the idea. It's called Reiki. Your mom, I understand, is a Reiki practitioner. And it's interesting because I think Fred loves his mother and is not really quite sure what to do about that. I think he part of him doesn't really, wants to think that it's just bunk, and I think part of him also wants to accept his mom and the other people that she's involved with as you know, at least acknowledge how much they're putting into this, how much they believe it, how much their intentions are good, even though part of him might feel, well, that's kind of goofy and doesn't really make any sense, and why should that do anything. Have you had some experience of this yourself through your mom?
Oh, I'm sure that some of this is coming from personal experience. Yeah, yeah. And in terms of my you know, ways of grappling with other people's beliefs, you know, and especially people close to me, and eventually, you know, I don't know that it would be my, you know, primary mode of expressing my, you know, my way of being in the world, but Fred, a lot of my subjects start off as being sort of satires, and then I, you know, like the deeper I look into it, I say, well, there's something there, you know, like, and there's something interesting there, and so the Reiki people in the novel, there's some Zen people in the novel too, which are very comic characters in some way, but then there's an element of where they get the last laugh in some ways too, you know, like just in terms of the joking around, you know, and the sense of humor that they have in the book. I was it was part of my research. At first, I went and decided, okay, I'm going to go get a Reiki attunement for my mom. And once I got into this world and started talking to these people and meeting these people, it was a fun and interesting experience and a deepening one for me too.
We have a caller here. Let's talk with him in DeWitt County. This is our toll free line. Line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes.
I was interested in why you chose the sparkly helmet, you know, a technological approach rather than perhaps an entheogenic pharmaceutical like in the movie Altered States. Was it to have more a fiction of control over the experience?
Yeah, you know, there's been a lot of research into different drugs that can bring on different states, I felt like with the helmet there was an ability to really go in look at the ways in which very very specific brain regions could be turned on and off and experimented like that, but there is, you know, that's another way that I could have gone in the novel. Definitely was through you know, different kinds of drugs and pharmaceuticals. There's been a lot of interesting research in that direction too.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I'm not sure that it would the opportunity for imagery and would have been quite the same if the person just laid down and took a pill. It wouldn't be quite as good as the sparkly helmet.
Yeah, and it also ties in later on with different ways that the technology is, you know, he's seeing technology. I mean, the technology of the computer software that they're working on and the technology of George's treatment, you know, where George goes and gets a CAT scan and Fred watches that, you know, the brain regions coming in. So it was, I didn't plan these things out, but it allowed for a lot of connections.
Yeah. I have an email from someone here and I hope that I can convey the point. I think it's kind of interesting that the person writes that her husband, who was devout as a child but since has become agnostic, has long believed that religion and spirituality is a creation of the mind, which actually in his case gives it some credibility for him. Were it simple faith based on some external influences, as the person writes, you know, parents, churches, readings, etc., it wouldn't have the power and strength that it does coming from within. So there, I think that's interesting because some people would say, well, if it's just a sort of an artifact of some brain state, then is it really real? Well, but if it actually is something that's happening inside that person, then at least for them, it is real.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, Mira Eghart, the woman who's running the study and along with her father, Craig Eghart, the two of them, see religion very differently. Craig is your typical scientist in the way that he, you know, he's very he's very much an atheist, and he's very and he originally invents the helmet, he's thinking, in order to disprove all of this, you know. And Mira takes a different tack where she wants to try to have a kind of faith. She calls it a faith without ignorance. But it was interesting for me, you know, how all these terms change over the course of the novel. What does real mean? What does ignorance mean? And these are terms that, you know, what is faith? And what is a military entertainment complex? These are all sort of terms which evolve and change over the course of the novel. And so I think the way that we think about things, the way that we, you know, the way that we frame things in our mind is central to to what these questions are about. I mean, for the term ignorance is used in spiritual traditions, you know, to mean the veil of ignorance, the veil of Maya. And so there are all these different ways that you can look at things. And this is a little bit off of the topic of the question, but I'm just riffing a little bit.
I mean,
the military entertainment complex. Just to choose an example from the book of a term, which, you know, starts off meaning one very specific thing to Fred, but then it takes on the deeper Fred goes into it, He starts thinking, in what ways am I a military entertainment complex in miniature? You know, in what ways are our minds kind of these, you know, designed to be these things that are trying to defend against or attack or, you know, involved in this endless process of defending territory or trying to gain more of it. And I'm interested in and also in the Savage Girl in a very different way, in taking sort of the macrocosm and the world, and taking our inner experience and finding the real relations between the two of those and how they're interrelated. With the Savage Girl, it was more about the issues had more to do with consumerism. In Luminarium, it has more to do with our sort of larger systems of belief.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop. My apologies. I have somebody here that we can't take. Our guest, Alex Shakar, he teaches fiction writing here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and his novels are The Savage Girl, and then the brand new one that we've been talking about, Luminarium, published by Soho Press. You can go out and find them in the bookstore or in the library, and I recommend them. And thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. This was a show that we first broadcast on January 18th. There are many programs available for you to listen to anytime that you are ready. So you can go to our website. That way you can also check the schedule for upcoming shows. That's all at will.illinois.edu. Just go to the Focus section. I do also want to mention that the program that we had planned for this morning will be rescheduled. We're not quite sure, but we were planning and talking in this first hour about the issue of mental health of college and university students and how universities are dealing with the kind of challenges that come with having students that do have some mental health issues. We were going to talk with Ben Locke from Penn State. He was not feeling well this morning, and we said, well, that's fine. We'll just do it on another day. So you can look forward to that sometime on some future Focus.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
In the second part of the program today, we do have a new live show, so we hope you can stick around for that. And we will be talking with Dario Maestropieri from the University of Chicago. He is somebody who studies primate behavior and also human behavior, social behavior in both cases. And we will talk about some of what you will find in a new book that he has authored that's just recently come out. And the title of the book is Games Primates Play. The subtitle is An Undercover Investigation of the Evolution and Economics of Human Relationships. And in this book, he says there are really many parallels between the kind of social games we play in our relationships and those played by our closest animal relatives. And although we might not be aware of it, there are a series of very clear rules that govern our social relationships, and they're much the same as they are in our close animal relatives. So we'll be talking about that coming up in the second part of the show. We will take a break here, as we usually do, so we can bring you an update on the commodity markets. And then at 1 minute past the hour, we'll have news for you from National Public Radio. So we hope you'll stick around.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at mid-session, we see soybean futures on the defensive today, pretty much mirroring what happened in the overnight trade amid speculative selling that has been tied today to global economic worries, particularly in Greece and China, and some technical considerations as soybeans have been on a multi-day slide. Corn and wheat futures, though, are on the positive side today. Traders apparently unwinding spreads that were long on beans and short on corn or wheat. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. In Kansas City, May wheat not trading, but the July at 615.5 is up 5.5. September at 630.5 up 4.5. May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 604 up 11.25. July 599.75 up 2.75. September 615 up 3.25. May corn 615 up 7. July 684 up 3. September 516.5 up 5 and a